also the other really interesting thing about working up in Njolesund is that you can talk to the Norwegians who've been there year after year. They come back and they've been working there for decades. And you talk to them about the changes that they've seen, and they're not worried about the changes that they've seen over the last 30, 40 years. They're worried about what they've seen over the last 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's really, that is possibly the most darkest reminder I've had. And, you know, I know about all of this. I should know about all of this, but we just have someone in front of you saying that. It's like, yeah, I'm not worried about what's happened over decades. It's the last few years. That's just how quickly it's accelerating.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ice, the podcast from the British Antarctic Survey, where we brief you on newsworthy climate and ecosystem science from the polar regions. My name's Em Newton, and today I'm talking to Professor Kate Hendry and Dr. Kelly Hogan. Now, in this episode, Kelly is joining us from the Arctic Circle Assembly in Iceland. As a result, there's a bit of background noise throughout this interview from that big international meeting. Yeah, why not? Let's go for it.
Cool.
So, Kelly, you're joining us from the Arctic Circle Assembly in Reykjavik. Can you tell us more about what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm at the Arctic Circle Assembly. It's a big conference that happens every year. There's about 2,000 or 2,500 people, I think I've heard people say, this year. And they are people from anyone with an interest in the Arctic. So they're people from governments, from universities, companies, research institutions, and indigenous and local peoples. And so anyone that has an interest in the changes that are happening in the Arctic or in governing the Arctic are here to talk about it and to discuss it in a sort of a big group. And what's brilliant about it is that you get to talk between, you get a chance to talk to government or politicians or policymakers that you might not necessarily get as a scientist at a science conference. So that is really fantastic. And the thing I'm doing here is to talk a bit about the work we were doing in Greenland last summer on our research ship and how the UK is well positioned to keep working and keep doing research in the Arctic.
Great. Sounds like a really important meeting and kind of like an alternative opportunity to something like COP, where there's a really kind of specific policy outcome that everyone's fighting for. And this sounds like a much more kind of open, collaborative space.
I think I've been surprised at how this is my first time at the Arctic Circle Assembly. And I have been surprised at how frank and open the conversations are. So everyone is very open to talking about the challenges that there are in the Arctic, be that in terms of sort of national security or the security of the Arctic region, to climate change and to working with indigenous or local populations. And everyone's been very frank and open, and that is very refreshing. And I think that's, you know, it leads to very productive conversations. And it's not all about the science. So it definitely makes you think in a different way about the region that we're interested in working in and are working in.
Amazing. Well, speaking of that region, both of you have obviously traveled quite a bit for fieldwork in the Arctic. And we'll get onto the specifics of that work in a bit. But just as humans going to these remote places, it's one of those places that very few people will ever really get to go to, whatever part of the Arctic you're going to. Kate, can you paint a bit of a picture about what it's actually like to go there, like the landscapes, the animals, the climate?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's very hard to really paint a full picture of it. It sort of ends up sounding quite cliched, really. You know, it's a staggeringly beautiful place to be. And I've only been up to the Arctic really in spring through autumn times, shall we say. I've never been there in the depths of winter before, which must be a whole different experience again. But in the summer, it's 24-hour daylight. And where I've been most of the time is coastal regions. So you get to see glaciers carving into the ocean, which is absolutely staggering. And in terms of wildlife, you know, it's all the, you know, amazing larger megafauna that everyone gets excited about. You know, it's really hard not to get excited about seeing a polar bear. They are just enormous. And I think it's the size of them you just never really quite get over. In terms of living there, so I've done various bits of Arctic fieldwork, but this summer I was up in a research town, if you like, called Njolesund on Svalbard. And Svalbard's a really interesting place generally. Its governance is quite interesting, but it's sort of generally looked after by the Norwegians. And Njolesund is a town run by a Norwegian company, which is basically made up of lots of different research stations from different countries. So I was staying at the UK Arctic Research Station, but there are stations there that are run by other countries, so Germany and Italy and Korea and China and so on. But we all work together, we all live together, we all eat together. And it's this really quite amazing collaborative space, really. So not only are you in this stunning environment, you're also in this really extraordinary cultural space as well, I suppose.
Oh, how wonderful. And I've heard that Norrlösund also used to be a place where there was a lot of coal mining. Mm. So what a turnaround for the location and then as a site of international collaboration.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's it was a mining town up until the sort of early mid 20th century. And then it was sort of taken over for scientific purposes. But the other role it now plays, I suppose, is that it's really huge for tourism. So the tourist ships come in summer. And in the height of summer, there can be two or three big tourist ships coming in every day. So tourists will get to walk around. You're part of the tourist attraction, which is very strange. It's sort of like Science Town, but it's something to get used to. But there's a little museum, a little shop, and so they like to go and, you know, find out about the local place.
Yeah,
and, it's all part of the experience.
Norrlösund's, I think, 79 degrees north, and in some ways it's kind of extraordinary that you've got kind of cruise ships turning up there with regularity, and there's a museum, people are kind of quite happily living there. And yeah, it seems an odd place for humans to be thriving so well. Do you think that's a more recent phenomenon?
It is, yes. I mean, the people who've been living in Norrlösund have not been living there that long in the grand scheme of things. They're not indigenous populations. They are people who've come from Norway. But, you know, it was a thriving town at the turn of the 20th century. It is the most northerly permanently inhabited town in the world.
Just to say that the other interesting thing about Svalbard's history is that it actually started off life really as a place where people were exploiting minerals and going for whaling. So in the 16th and 17th centuries, that's what, as Svalbard, the islands were being discovered by people on ships, they were going into the fjords and whaling. And they did, you know, basically fish the whale populations out of the fjords, as in they killed a lot of them. And, you know, so, and then they stopped going there. But it has a really interesting history of people going there and trying to, you know, and trying to exploit either the mineral resources or the natural resources in terms of marine mammals. And then, you know, luckily when the whalers stopped going there, you know, the whales did come back to the fjords. And, you know, you do see beluga whales in the main fjord in the main town in Longyearbyen, for example. So it's a really... It's got a really rich sort of cultural background, but as Kate said, not with indigenous peoples. These are all people coming in from elsewhere to these barren lands, you know, so it's got a really interesting background.
That's so interesting. And I guess also in contrast to the very northern parts of Canada, where there are a number of different indigenous communities, long-standing communities. And then so, and Kelly, you've recently been to Greenland. Is that very much the same, or is there kind of more diversity in the Arctic landscape?
I guess places in the Arctic are a bit more similar to each other than they are similar to the Antarctic, for example. And you do get the same sort of big fjords, like if you've seen on the telly, like Norwegian fjords with a glacier at the top of it and some small icebergs in it. And then, but also big steep mountains on either side. You do get that around most of the coast of Greenland. And we were in East Greenland this summer, and that is very much very steep hills. So the mountains above us were rising 1,000 meters out of the water, you know, almost like a vertical rock face. And then we had several glaciers that were cutting down through that and then draining into the fjord itself. So yes, I mean, as Kate described, it's an incredibly beautiful place to work. And I think that maybe one thing that, you know, was interesting to see this summer was just how much meltwater there was, how much running water there was. So there was many, many big waterfalls coming off the sides of these fjord valleys and also off the ice themselves. So you could actually visibly see, you know, the ice melting and the product of that in the summer. And that is, you know, that is normal for Greenland and for Svalbard, that you have a melt season in the summer and then everything sort of freezes up again in the winter. But as we know, that melting is increasing and the summer melt seasons are getting longer. And the ice is, and we're losing ice, so the ice sheets and the glaciers are retreating. So, you know, it's not all positive, but it was really interesting to be in that environment when there's so much running water around, and that is quite different to the Antarctic, for example.
And when you were there changes that were visible to the landscape?
I don't think we could sleep. I mean, we were there for about 6 weeks this summer, and we worked in four different fjords and along the coast. So we probably weren't in, there long enough to see changes, but you could see, so like the waterfalls, you could see water that was coming out from underneath the glaciers and actually flowing out. I mean, you could see it with your eyes moving past the ship that we were on because it's moving so fast. So that's a lot of water that's coming off the ice sheet, you know, when we were there. So, you know, actually watching that, we could, you know, we were sort of mesmerized by watching the melting actually happening in front of our eyes. So you are seeing changes. But one of the fjords that we went into, so no one had ever surveyed in there. Fishermen go in there and they go to catch their catches of whatever they're looking for that time. No one had ever surveyed in there. And when we were there, we looked up some of the historical maps from Greenland about where the ice used to be and some old sort of aerial photographs from the 1980s. And where we were working had been covered by ice in the 1980s. You know, it had been sort of several kilometres. The ice had been several kilometres further out. And so we were on basically fresh seafloor, fresh territory. Within my lifetime, within our lifetimes, you know, the ice has moved back several kilometres and we were working in a brand new piece of seafloor, if you like. So that is pretty stark, and it's a pretty heavy reminder of what's happening with our climate and how it's affecting our cryosphere here.
So the other really interesting thing about working up in Njolesund is that you can talk to the Norwegians who've been there year after year. They come back and they've been working there for decades. And you talk to them about the changes that they've seen. And they're not worried about the changes that they've seen over the last 30, 40 years. They're worried about what they've seen over the last 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's really, that is possibly the most darkest reminder I've had. And, I know about all of this. I should know about all of this. But we just have someone in front of you saying that. It's like, yeah, I'm not worried about what's happened over decades. It's the last few years. That's just how quickly it's accelerating.
Wow. Okay, So you hear the phrase, the Arctic is one of the fastest changing places on Earth, a lot. And the latest figure is that it's warming 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. But what does that actually mean? How can it be that a particular area of the planet is warming faster than the rest?
So that's really a phenomenon that we term polar amplification. And it's related to how the atmosphere and the oceans move around the planet. When you have a warming planet, we predict that the poles will warm faster than the rest of the planet. So it's partly that. It's partly just a case of basic planetary physics, really. There are also what we term feedbacks in the polar regions too. So these are processes that can also add to effects more sort of locally, if you fact. I mean, these are processes that can act more locally as well as having a global impact. So, for example, in the Arctic, if you start warming the air in the oceans, it's likely you're going to start melting sea ice more. If you melt sea ice, you actually change how much of the energy coming in from the sun can be reflected back into space. And that's an example of this sort of positive feedback. So if you melt sea ice, less of the radiation is reflected back into space in the sun, and so the planet will warm. Well, the area will warm, and that will also have knock-on effects for
the
global
temperatures. And that's literally just the albedo effect,
that
isn't
is,
it?
From, that's the albedo from effect.
Yeah. School level
exactly,
science,
exactly,
the white reflects better than the kind of darkness of the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And do we know why we've not seen the same phenomenon in Antarctica then?
Yeah, so I think that one of the reasons that we don't see such visible changes, or we haven't seen so much warming in the Antarctic yet, is because of the way that the ocean currents move on the planet. So Antarctica is sort of surrounded by a big ocean current that goes all the way around it as a landmass called the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. And that sort of acts to isolate it thermally from heat getting from the equator down to the pole, down to the South Pole. And the Arctic doesn't have that same phenomenon. And, you know, we all benefit from the Gulf Stream bringing warm water up from, you know, from the equator up to Western Europe. And that's why we're so much warmer here than equivalent latitudes in Canada. But in the Antarctic, that transport of heat from the equator to the pole is sort of stopped, or at least, you know, inhibited by this big current that moves around it. And you get the same phenomenon in the atmosphere. And so it sort of protects Antarctica from the same thermal effects. But that doesn't mean to say that it's not warming. It is warming in Antarctica. But the rate of change is lower there.
I think there's also interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere around Antarctica that results in a lot of variability. Mm-hmm. And the more variability, like background noise you have, if you like, in climate records, the more it's quite difficult to pick out longer term trends. And we don't have the long term data sets that we really need to understand that baseline, especially in Antarctica. Records are much longer in the Arctic. We've got, you know, historical records as well going back hundreds of years. So in the Antarctic, we just don't have that wealth of information. So it's just really a lot harder to pick out those longer term trends.
So when we talk about the Arctic having a stronger warming rate, it can make it sound like it's somehow very separate and isolated to other zones of the planet, but it is highly connected. And that is the kind of question behind both of your areas of research, actually. What role has the Arctic been playing so far in the balance of the global climate? How is it connected to our wider global systems?
So through atmospheric connections, what goes on the Arctic doesn't really stay in the Arctic. It will impact our weather systems too. So I think it's 4 out of the main 6 weather patterns, weather systems that we get in the UK come either straight from the Arctic or from the subpolar regions. So we're heavily influenced by what's going on in terms of atmospheric processes in the Arctic. But also those influences extend to the oceans as well. So the Arctic really, as it were, sets the balance of the amount of fresh water that gets into the Atlantic and the Pacific. And that really controls the really large scale ocean circulation processes that moves heat and carbon and nutrients around the planet. So if the Arctic changes, that will change the entire sort of conveyor belt, if you like, of what's moving around the oceans. And then I guess sort of moving a little bit more towards the sort of work that that we do in my research group as well. It's not just heat, but it's that carbon I talked about. So the Arctic sets the amount of carbon and nutrients in large parts of the ocean as well. So changes in biological activity that will be linked to things like changes in ocean physics and sea ice and so on in the Arctic will be felt much further afield by biology in the mid and low latitudes as well.
The other, so Kate really nicely described how, you know, when you change the climate and you add more freshwater nutrients to the ocean, you start to change the ocean circulation. But the other thing that you do, if you start to melt, you know, large reservoirs of ice that are stored in, of water that are stored in ice in the Arctic. And so really we're talking about the Greenland ice sheet here, but also the glaciers in Svalbard and the Canadian Arctic as well. You know, as you melt those, that water directly drains into our oceans and our sea levels, our global sea level is rising as a consequence. So far, a lot of the sea level rise that we have seen from melting ice sheets and glaciers has come from Greenland. And that is because the Arctic has warmed more rapidly than the Antarctic and because it was warmer to begin with. So in Greenland, you get a lot of melting of the ice sheet from the very top, from the sun top down. About 50% of the melting that happens in Greenland is just done by the sun acting on the surface of the ice sheet and then making meltwater, and that runs off into the ocean. The other 50% more or less comes from the glaciers that drain out the sides of the ice sheet. And so far, Greenland has been the bigger contributor to global sea level rise from ice sheets and glaciers than Antarctica, and that's really to do with Antarctica being a bit more isolated by the ocean currents and the atmospheric currents. But going forwards, there is a lot more ice in Antarctica that could melt and could make a bigger impact on sea level rise. So, you know, we do need to look at both polar regions to understand that and to try to be able to predict and therefore help policymakers and people who want to make mitigation or adaptation plans for sea level rise. You know, we need to look at both these places and to understand what's going on there.
So Kelly, you led the Kangerlak expedition this summer around Greenland, again studying those glaciers terminating kind of at sea level. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the Kangerlak project, so I co-lead this project with my colleague in Colm McCoffey at Durham University. This project is quite a nice summary of all the things that we've talked about. So we are studying those glaciers that drain right into the ocean. And what we are looking at or trying to understand is how warm water, predominantly from the Atlantic, gets into the fjords and actually melts the glaciers. The way that we're doing that part is to look at the last time the global temperatures or temperatures in the Arctic were higher than they are today. So we're looking at a time about 9,000 years ago when air temperatures were 2 to 4 degrees warmer in the Arctic than they are today. So we're trying to say, okay, what happened to the ice sheet then? How much did it melt? How quickly did it lose ice? And then, you know, and how did that all happen? And that will help us to understand what will happen in the future as our temperatures get warmer. But the other side of the project, which links quite nicely to what Kate does, was also looking at, so if you start to melt the glaciers and you bring a lot of that fresh water into the fjords and into the coastal seas, they bring nutrients with them. So what happens to the marine ecosystems that live in those areas at the time? If you bring lots of nutrients, you get more productivity, and more carbon is taken up by organisms. More of them live and produce, and then they die and fall through the water column. So what happens to that carbon in the system? Does it actually stay buried on the seafloor, or does it come back out into the water and then be re-emitted? So potentially, as we melt more of Greenland, we have a mechanism to store more carbon in fjords as sediments, as the productivity changes. So, you know, it's actually quite a nice, the project actually tackles these two topics that we've been talking about in terms of melting ice sheets and glaciers, and then also what is going to happen to biodiversity and the marine ecosystems going forwards as our climate continues to get warmer.
Cool. So you kind of doing a bit of detective work effectively, so trying to look for evidence about how those different factors changed in the past and then using that to extrapolate what might now happen in the future.
Yeah. Well, all science is detective work because we're always super curious and we just want to know the answers to the questions. We want to understand how things work and why things happen. But yes, you're totally right. What's kind of cool about this project is that we went there and we were measuring today how much warm water is getting in, how much fresh water is coming off, what are the organisms that live in the water column, how are they changing or reacting to the nutrients that are there. So we look at what's going on today. But then we're also taking seafloor sediment cores. So, and these are from the layers of sediments that are laid down on the seafloor. So if you imagine, if you go deeper down the seafloor, you're going back further and further in time. And so then we get a record of how much carbon is in those sediments. And also we can look at things like foraminifera, which tell us different foraminifera lives in different water temperatures. So we can also look back at the record of warm water coming into the fjords. So we can actually look back, we can use the past and, you know, when we know that temperature was warmer in the Arctic, and we can try to measure what the ocean was doing and, you know, how many nutrients were getting into the water column and what the productivity was doing at the same time as well. So we will use the present, we will also use the past to try to give us some constraints about what might happen in the future. So it is sort of the triple whammy, if you like.
Nice. I think there was also some geology work going on to look at the speed of the speed with which the ice was melting in the last kind of 9,000 years.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, I'm a geologist by training, so if there wasn't geology, there'd be a problem. But we also had some people, you know, we were lucky enough to get helicopters on board the SDA this summer, and so they were with us for about 12 days, and they were taking terrestrial geologists onshore to get rock samples to date the last time ice melted from the area and exposed those rocks. And the idea behind that is to try to work out when those rocks were last uncovered, when the air temperatures were 2 to 4 degrees warmer, and that was about 9,000 years ago. It's a time period called the Holocene thermal maximum. So when that happened, how much did the ice sheet thin and then the glaciers go back? So they were getting the rock samples to look at that thinning rate back through time. And that will give us a constraint, you know, to put into a computer model to model how much, if you put the air temperature up by 2 degrees, how much ice do you lose? How much thickness do you lose? So that was really brilliant capability of the ship to be able to take people ashore whilst we were doing the offshore work, or, you know, the marine sampling at the same time. So we were doing, you know, double science, you know, several days when we were there. So that was absolutely brilliant.
Is the temperature of the ocean at all important to this picture?
Yeah. So what we are trying to look at in the fjords, or what we're seeing more and more in Greenland, and this is also in Svalbard, is warm Atlantic water making its way in through the fjords right up to the ice and actually causing more melting and accelerating how quickly we can make icebergs or how quickly we carve icebergs. So, you know, this has been a concern for a long time. It's a concern for local people in Greenland as well, because they are concerned where the fish are, and the temperature of the water dictates which fish species is in each fjord. So that's actually really important to them as well. But yes, a lot of the changes at these glaciers that drain into the ocean are happening because, or in part because this warm water is getting in and doing the melting. So we need to trace that, see how warm the water is, and then actually tie that to how much ice we're losing in each, you know, for each glacier to try to understand, you know, the exact mechanisms of how that happens. We don't have a great handle on that in the big computer models that we use to look at the whole Earth system. And that, you know, that's a problem. It holds back, you know, or it makes us less certain about our predictions for the future.
And I think one of the big side effects of glaciers melting seems to be the kind of input of fresh water into the fjord. How does that just change things for organisms that are living there, or does that have a wider impact on currents and circulation?
Well, of course, that the immediate impact is in the individual fjords that you're in. But, you know, one of the big sort of climate tipping points that we're aware of for the Greenland ice sheet today really is if you start to increase melt rapidly from the Greenland ice sheet and that makes its way out to the North Atlantic, you get a sort of very cold, fresh layer on the top there, and it stops the circulation, the sort of big ocean circulation that Kate was talking about before, from happening. It sort of it makes that less powerful. And so what would actually happen is those big ocean currents that bring heat to Western Europe would slow down. And there are some models that predict that that whole system might shut down by 2040, which is not very far away. And so it's a terrifying prospect, because if you imagine, you know, us not being able to farm all the crops that we farm and, you know, being as cold as equivalent latitudes in Canada, you know, our whole way of life in Europe would change. But there is uncertainty with that, and that's part of why we have to keep doing these studies to try to narrow these uncertainties and try to find out when and if that actually might happen.
Wow. So the impact for Europe generally is actually pretty severe. Is there other parts of the world that could experience a similar shift as a result, or is it really Europe as a result of Arctic changes?
This global ocean circulation system is truly global. So any slowdown or change in those currents or where the currents are going will be the case everywhere too. So anywhere else where warm currents are being brought up from tropical regions to higher latitudes will have similar sort of impacts. So anywhere on a where you've got these strong ocean boundary currents, we call them, like the Gulf Stream, will be influenced in the same way. So it could be also the case in the Pacific, for example.
Okay, so speaking of ocean currents, can we talk about cycling and your project in New Orleans?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, cycling, actually, it's an acronym that stands for silicon cycling in glaciated environments. Silicon in particular, I work on a lot. It's one of those nutrients that we've been talking about, one of those really important nutrients. And silicon is needed by everything on Earth. You don't really sort of think about it as a key nutrient. You might think about things like nitrate and phosphate that you put on your plants in the garden. Yeah. But everything also needs silicon, us included. Most organisms need it in fairly small amounts, but some things need it in much higher amounts. And one of the important forms of algae that grow in water are called diatoms, and they make their cell walls out of silica, basically out of glass. So they need lots of silicon. And they're responsible for a huge amount of the carbon export, especially in the polar oceans. So really key organism to understand.
And that's because they're some of the interface between the atmosphere and then kind of marine life that's then
absolutely. Yeah,
carbon.
Yeah. So diatoms, they're photosynthetic algae. So they take up carbon from the atmosphere and they lock it up in organic matter. So they not only form the sort of the basis of the food chain, if you like, in the oceans, they're kind of like the plants of the ocean. So everything feeds on them. But also they're really important for that carbon cycling. So when diatoms die, they tend to sort of clump together. They're quite dense because they've got these big silica shells. So they sink really easily and quickly. So they're really good at transferring that carbon that organic matter from the surface of the ocean down into the deep, into the sediments where some of it will get locked away. So really important for carbon cycling. So really the point of cycling is to understand how climate change in the polar regions is influencing how silicon is getting into the oceans and moving around. And in particular, I've been working for a few years now on trying to understand the role that glaciers have in all of this. So glaciers, these massive glaciers, when they move over rocks, will grind the rock underneath them. They're so big. And it produces this really fine material. We call it glacial flour because it's so fine. So it looks a little bit like flour that you use to bake cakes. And I think for decades, people thought glaciers were these sort of inert environments. It was cold. There wasn't really anything going on. But now we know that glaciers themselves, firstly, they're full of life. They're full of microbial life themselves. But also they're chemically really strange underneath. So they're like little like nutrient factories or big nutrient factories.
Okay.
And they produce a lot of this flour and this stuff gets into the ocean. And what I've been working on with colleagues and other groups around the world is just understanding how this flour basically has so much like really good source of nutrients, basically really reactive stuff that will dissolve in seawater and be there available for the algae that need them. And so silicon's important, silicon's released this way, but other things as well. So other nutrients like phosphates, but also trace elements that everything needs, including algae. So iron, for example, mm-hmm. iron and manganese are both released in these in this glacial flour as well.
Does it depend on the kind of rock it's going over?
That's a really good question. So that's one thing we're looking at in cycling. So not only are we working in Svalbard, but we've also been working over the last year or so in places like Iceland, but also Greenland, and we're also going down to Antarctica. So partly it's to look at different polar regions, so the Arctic versus the Antarctic, and how do these things differ? But also things like, you know, we can use all these different samples to look at the impact of different rock types, for example. So Iceland is made of basalt. Basalt is a really reactive type of rock. Not reactive, like it's not going to start exploding or anything, but it will. It's just that quite a bit more reactive in terms of just releasing stuff into seawater when it hits seawater. Whereas Svalbard's made, a lot of Svalbard's made up of quite old, not quite inert rock. So it's actually kind of like the other end of the spectrum, if you like. So we can compare the two and see how the rock types make a difference. And we think they do. Our the evidence we have so far is that it actually makes a really huge difference.
Okay, so are these glacier factories, is there an equivalent process in any other part of nature you can think of? I off the top of my head, it doesn't seem like there's anything of an equivalent scale that would be doing this level of kind of grinding of the rock.
It is quite a special environment in that way. We think these processes are going on in rivers everywhere, but it's just sort of, on steroids under glaciers because of that grinding. By making those rock particles so tiny, you actually make a much bigger surface area for all these reactions to happen. So it just speeds everything up, basically.
I was going to ask, so are any other nutrients produced by the same process that are also important, or is it really silicon that is there?
So lots of other things are probably also released this way. So in particular, it's likely important for cycling of iron in particular. What we think is going on is, just to make our heads spin a bit more, is that silicon and iron and other things like phosphorus, but also organic carbon, all interact together. And we're really just trying to get our heads around how complex these different chemical reactions can be. So a lot of what we're trying to do in cycling as well is really get to grips with how these nutrients interact together in this environment and what this might mean for biology.
That's really interesting. And it seems to cross so many different areas of science as well in that one question.
Yeah. And that's why I love this area of research, really, because it brings together chemistry, physics and biology, really. It has to.
And in terms of the impact, I guess, for both of your areas of research on the ecosystems that are in these places, I recently went to New Orleans and I spoke to a researcher called Max Willem, who was working at the Alfred Wegener Institute. And she was trying to understand how the warming water impacted on the stress experienced by polar cod. And the warming water itself, before you thought about any of the wider chemical changes, was starting to have a stress impact on the fish themselves. What is the current role of that marine life at the moment for humans and for the planet? And how might that shift if we see significant changes in the Arctic?
By melting glaciers, you know, you could be shifting the nutrients that you put into the ocean. As Kelly talked about, one of these things could be, you know, you might think of it as a positive thing because you're putting more nutrients in, so you could be driving more production. And so more food available for the food chain, but also more carbon being taken up. But if you change the balance of the nutrients, so the ratio of the nutrients to each other, you can actually have unexpected consequences. So you could be changing the type of algae that grow. So in some parts of the polar regions, we're seeing shifts away from diatom-dominated algal populations to other types of algae that aren't really tasty for anything. So it actually has these massive knock-on effects for the rest of the food chain. And in terms of what it means for us, you know, these are, especially in the Arctic, they're economically important areas for fisheries. So it could be really critical for fisheries stocks in terms of, you know, the temperature stress that you mentioned already, but potentially also these shifts in food sources could be influencing where the fish can grow.
Kate is absolutely right. The Arctic is an incredibly economically important area for fishing, and it sustains a lot of livelihoods across the Arctic, including local and indigenous peoples. And I think that, you know, we need to be really mindful that is the, you know, the effect of sort of climate change, you know, human induced climate change is affecting these people disproportionately. And that's something that we really, you know, we really need to take care of, be aware of, and communicate with them about. You know, it's very serious. Sorry to be a downer.
No, it's kind of hard to talk about this stuff without.
It's hard, yeah. It's hard to talk about it, but it's realistic.
I guess just going back to the ice itself, is there a consensus on the warming and melting trajectory of the Arctic? And do we know if lower levels of emissions can still prevent significant ice loss in the Arctic?
Yeah, I think we're on a trajectory that's something closer to the sort of 4.5 degree warming, you know, based on the sort of emission scenarios that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change sets out. And that's what all the models, they look at these different amounts of temperature increase, and then they say, well, how much melting is going to happen in Greenland and Antarctica, and how will sea levels rise, and what will happen to ecosystems? So we are on, you know, a bad trajectory, but, you know, we are able to cut emissions, and people are, you know, governments are committing. So I was just in a session yesterday here where both China and India had politicians, ministers for their environment, and they were committing to less coal-fired power stations and to cutting their emissions later than the UK has. So they were, so China was saying they want to be carbon neutral by 2060. So, you know, but they are, you know, they are the two biggest emitters of carbon dioxide, China and India. And it was quite, it was good to hear that they are committing to those things, and that if we do that, then we definitely take ourselves into a very much less bad situation in terms of what we're doing to the environment. And, you know, I think, you know, the power of the people who are here to talk about it and to influence each other, and the power of scientists to cut across geopolitics in this sphere, and the power of young people to then, you know, to then, you know, who are very much more aware of this problem than I was at their age, you know, as sort of teenagers at school, you know, 20 somethings, you know, they have power, and they will, unfortunately, they are going to be the ones, you know, dealing with this in, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years time. And, you know, but they do have a very strong voice. And I think that's really positive, you know, being able to communicate this stuff, being aware, so much more aware, is really helping. And I think, you know, we still have the ability to make positive change.
Fantastic. And on that note, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Ice. And if you did, we'd love you to leave us a rating or review on the podcast platform that you're listening from. It will help other people find the podcast, as will sharing it with friends, family and colleagues. Thanks for that. Next time, I'm going to be talking to some scientists investigating a particular kind of cloud above the Southern Ocean. Now, those clouds are particularly interesting because they're one of the largest remaining uncertainties in the models that we use to simulate our climate and predict how it might change. They're doing some really interesting fieldwork to discover more about how those clouds are formed from the RRS Sir David Attenborough in the Southern Ocean and from the air flying from Rothera Research Station in Antarctica. See you next time.